This is our third Sunday in, or is it our second? It's our second Sunday in Habakkuk. It's a little-known prophetic book. It's one of those minor prophets back toward the end of the Old Testament. I would imagine that even if you've been in church your whole lifetime, you may have never, ever heard a sermon preached or a Bible lesson from the book of Habakkuk. It's not one of the most known or more popular books in the Bible. It very appropriately has very good application to a lot of things that we see going on around us today. And just remember, he's called a minor prophet, not because he was minor, not because he was short, or because he wasn't particularly good looking or anything like that. He's minor only because this book only has three short chapters in it. But his message is poignant. His message is good. But his message is not one that's easy to listen to. Remember, he lived in the same days that Jeremiah did, and I'm not sure that any of the prophets were more persecuted than Jeremiah and his contemporaries, who were actually prophesying at this point. You need to understand that we're at the point in the history of Judah / Israel, to the point that hundreds of years have now passed, 800 years have passed, basically since Israel came out of Egypt and entered into the promised land. And they've been turbulent years. There have been high points. There have been times when the leadership was great and things in the country were much greater, where people had a greater heart for God. But at the same time, you understand that, unfortunately, a lot of that was unusual. Therefore, many of those years, if not most of those years, there was a real turning away from the God who had delivered Israel out of Egypt. We've seen our country undergo great moral decay in the last many years. But we have good reason to believe that as bad as things have gotten here, they're not quite as bad as they happen to have been at Habakkuk's day. At least in some ways. Remember, we said this is a conversation that takes place between the prophet and God. And in it, essentially, the prophet asks God a couple of questions, or makes a couple of complaints, rather, not asking questions. He complains to God about things he sees. And just remember, last week you could give a summary of it basically, but this, and it was saying, I call for help and you don't listen. I cry out violence and you do not save. Why do you tolerate wrong? Strife and conflict abound. The law is paralyzed. Justice is perverted. How can all this wicked and evilness go on, Lord, all around me? I see it. I hear it. And I pray to you. I pleaded with you to do something about it. But nothing comes. Well, Habakkuk is about to get his answer. And it's not the one he expected. It's not the one that he's not going to hear this and just be rejoicing. Lord, that's exactly what I've been wanting all along. Nah, 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 nah. He was shocked. Astounded when he heard what God and saw, remember, because he not only talked to him, but he showed him what he's about to do. And that's where we begin. So these are not the words of God speaking, these are the words of the Lord speaking to the, these are the words of the word. Words of the Lord speaking to the prophet. See, the nations and watch and be fearfully bewildered. be fearfully bewildered because I'm doing something in your days you would not believe if he told you. In other words, Habakkuk, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do, and you're going to be bewildered by it. And you're going to believe it just can't be. Notice the barrage of verbs here. Look, watch, be astonished, wonder. Very descriptive kind of action verbs. They all have to do with seeing or reacting to what we see. One of the interesting things is God's answer to the prophet's prayer will not come internally from among the Jews. In other words, there have been times in the past when similar prayers to Habakkuk have been prayed. And the Lord has answered those prayers. Because he sent good leadership for the people at certain times. He sent prophets like Isaiah and Ezekiel and Jeremiah and all those other ones. He's also lifted up good and godly leadership at times. Judges sometimes. Samuel would be a good example of a good and godly judge that really had a great heart for God, who had something to do with some spiritual reformation that took place in his day. We know that King David is the one who was lifted up above all the other kings. And he's described by God himself as one after my own heart. We know something of Hezekiah and of Josiah, but you need to understand that for every one of those good and great ones, there were lots of them who were just plain flat wicked and evil. They had no sense of serving God. They had no sense of serving people. They were all about serving themselves. They saw their positions as positions of leadership, not to serve the people, but as positions for them to better themselves, increase their worldly wealth, increase their name among people. God could have brought Jesus at this time. He opted not to do that. But what you see through the days of the judges and what you see through the days of the kings is just hot and cold and hot and cold and hot and cold and hot and cold. And as you go on further, less hot and more cold, cold, cold. At the very best, lukewarm. And we know fundamentally what the issue was. The issue was this, is people just didn't have a heart for God. They had a heart for themselves. They only wanted him for what they thought they could get out of him. Do you think that might be pretty common in today's world? That there are people who want God only when they want him to do something for them or give them something. And the rest of the time, they want nothing at all to do with him. In other words, he's like their trump card in their back pocket. They pull him out whenever they need him, but when they don't, they stick him back in there and never pay him any attention. Are we guilty, at least to some degree, of the same sort of things? The Bible teaches us many things about God, and one of those is that he's long-suffering, which means that his patience almost seems to never come to an end. In Just remember the 40 years in the wilderness. Why were they there? Because they grumbled and complained against God. Why have the people suffered in Israel and Judah all these years? Because they grumbled against God. How many times in the wilderness, if you just read the stories in Numbers, the times in the wilderness when the people just push God and push God and push God, grumble, 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 grumble. Let's go back to Egypt. Let's go back to Egypt. It's better there. This God brought us out here just to kill us. Bam, 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 bam. And yet God was gracious. And God was good as he always is. The people were constantly, continually testing his patience. Now, if you have any children, you understand exactly what we're talking about here. Because every child will test the patience of their parent. And they will push. And they will push. But the problem with children is they don't know when to stop. Because before you know it, because mom and dads very often have a lot of patience. Because to be a good parent, you have to have patience. You can't be a good parent and not have patience. Those two things don't exist apart from one another. You have to have patience if you're going to be a good parent. Children are not stupid. But they're good at some things. And pushing things to the limit is very common course. But when patience goes away, they're very sorry. In other words, once mom and dad get to the breaking point, then they're going, uh-oh, I shouldn't have said that, I shouldn't have done that, because now they know they're going to suffer for it. You need to understand, the same thing was going on with Israel, between Israel and God all of those years, Israel constantly pushing him to the point. But that point had not come. God had endured it for thousands of years at this point. But the message of Jeremiah and the one of Habakkuk is this, is God has been long-suffering, that his patience is no longer, and it's no longer a question. God is coming in judgment, period. And you can imagine there were a lot of people going around telling everybody the exact opposite. Oh, you're the chosen people. Oh, God loves you. You're the greatest people there ever were. God's not going to come into Jerusalem. He's not going to do anything bad to you. He won't let anybody hurt you. And there were probably thousands of people saying that, and a few saying what Jeremiah and Habakkuk were saying. But guys, that's a message of Habakkuk, of Jeremiah right from the very beginning, and that is this, is it's too late. It doesn't matter what you do now. You've pushed God to the point, he's going to cut loose. The best thing you could do would be just to surrender and give yourselves over to the Babylonians, because he is, by the way, going to allow them to come into this land. And he is, by the way, going to allow them to come into the city. And he is, by the way, going to allow them to even come into his temple and desecrate it. Because his patience is over. Do you know there's some of the prophets that look upon Judah and Israel before this? And they're likened to Sodom and Gomorrah. We all know about Sodom and Gomorrah, right? Those two cities that stand out in the scripture as being so terribly morally corrupt and all of that, that God brought his judgment down upon them in hellfire and brimstone, right? Did you know there's scriptures that say that Judah at this point is worse than Sodom and Gomorrah? that Sodom and Gomorrah wouldn't have even done what Israel's done. The Lord is no longer threatening. He's coming. And he's coming in judgment. So why should the prophet be so surprised? Verse 6. Because I'm raising up the Chaldeans, which is another name for the Babylonians, the rebellious and swift people who walk across the whole earth to take ownership of dwelling places not theirs. Need to understand that when God spoke that first sentence, he got Habakkuk's attention. When he speaks this second sentence, Habakkuk's jaw hits the table. Out of all the people in the world, the Babylonians. See, God would be saying, see, I told you you weren't going to believe it. Babylonians are noted to have been some of the cruelest and most wicked conquerors in all of the history of the world. They were people so fierce that when people heard their names mentioned, their knees would knock. You realize that all these things that we're talking about here took place in what would today be modern-day Iraq, Syria, Jordan, places like that. There's always been war in the Middle East, right? Doesn't it seem like it? Can you ever remember a time that wasn't somebody was mad at somebody? It's one of those places in the world that's just been a hotbed of violence forever. I don't know if you agreed with President Bush when United States troops were sent in to conquer Iraq or not. That's not the issue before us at this point. I just want to ask you, do you remember the strategy that they used and what they called it? Shock and awe. Remember that? The whole idea was this, is that you would just blast the enemy so much, very rapidly and very quickly, that you would break them before the whole war got going very far. In other words, you would just scare the bejeebies out of them. I think it was a military exercise. It may have been unequaled in all of modern history, how rapidly the whole nation was taken over, basically, with a little bit of pockets here and there. But the vast majority of Iraq was taken within a matter of a week or two. A whole country. You'd have to say that maybe the war in Iraq was not that successful, but that first invasion part was just about as successful. They had to believe they had a great success in what resulted. You older people have heard about Hitler's Blitzkrieg in World War II, right? The same sort of thing. These rapid, massive invasions. Basically just bulldozing over countries because they didn't really know you were coming. They're not prepared for you at all. And just come plowing through your territory as if you're not even there. Germany gained lots of ground in just a very, very short time at the beginning of the war. The Babylonians didn't have all the instruments of war that we have available today. But you need to understand, this is basically what they did when they conquered people. They had their own ways of creating terror in their enemies. They were like the unstoppable people. And see, this is the thing with Habakkuk, because he knows a little bit. What he knows about them is they're like steamrollers. They're going through all over the place, and everywhere they go, there's hardly any resistance. They just take what they want. And no one can stand against them. By this time, they'd already swept westward and northwestward up through the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley, and they captured absolutely everything in their path. Now they've turned southward. And by the time they get through Judah, they've already been through Israel. For all practical purposes, up to this moment, they have shown themselves to be absolutely unstoppable by anybody. Even the king of Egypt had come with a massive army. And he passed through Judah and Israel, and then he fought, and he was defeated. So, I mean, there's literally nothing left standing between the Babylonians and this little teeny tiny country called Judah. The prophet Joel, if you're familiar with his prophecies, talks about them as a swarm of locusts consuming everything in their path. Verse 7, he is one being feared and dreaded. He is his own law and promotes honor to himself. Talking about the Babylonians. There are lots of great weapons of war, but I would imagine creating dread and fear in your enemy is perhaps the greatest one. That alone has probably won lots of wars without any other assistance. Can you remember when Joshua and Israel approached the land of Canaan the second time? Moses the first time, Joshua the second time. Can you remember what God did before they went in? Well, one of the things he made really clear is, I'm going in, you're just following me. Rahab, do you remember what she did? The prostitute at Jericho that had assisted the spies that Moses had sent in, or Joshua sent in. This is what she said to the spy. She said, our hearts melted. Our hearts melted because we heard what the Lord did to the Red Sea and how Israel defeated the Amorite kings as if they were not even there. That's kind of ad-libbing there, little last part. When the kings of the Amorites heard how the Lord had dried up the Jordan before Israel, their hearts melted. See, this is what's going on in Judah. The hearts of the people are melting. The hearts of the soldiers are melting because they are terrified and they're fearful. Wicked and evil people. They butchered people for little or no reason at all. They captured people. And one of the things that they were famous for was this, is they would take large hooks like fish hooks with a barb on them, and they would stick them into the flesh of people. And then they would tie all the people together with ropes and force them to march from one place to another. Now, what do you think would happen when somebody stumbled and fell? It's painful for everybody. Can you imagine? Anybody ever been stuck with a fish hook? I know Nancy has. What do you know about them? I've had to do this twice. Stephen came home from fishing one day, and he had a lure hanging on his chin or on his cheek. There's only one way to get a hook out, and that is to cut it off and push it the rest of the way through. Now, can you imagine having a large fish hook stuck in you that's tied to rope, that's tied to lots of other people? They say that when once the Babylonian conquest of Jerusalem took place and Nebuchadnezzar took the Jews back to Babylon to be exiled there, that it was a forced march all the way. That he refused to let them have any kind of reasonable, regular rest period. Do you know why? Because he did not want to give them opportunity to get down on their knees and pray to their God, because he was afraid their God would come and save them. So he would not let them sit down, lay down. The atrocities committed by the Babylonians and the Jews could only be described as being of the cruelest nature, very similar to what you would have found with the Jewish Holocaust in World War II. You understand that was the second Holocaust. The first one came at the hands of the Babylonians. Nebuchadnezzar even believed himself to be God. The time would come when the true and living God would show him differently. If you're familiar with the book of Daniel, and let me tell you, this is one of those historical things. It's not just mentioned in the Bible. It's also mentioned in extra-biblical historical records. So this is, no doubt about it, recorded in ancient history, even if you took the Bible out of it. He gets up one morning in Babylon, and he's so proud and arrogant about all the great and wonderful things he's accomplished. He's looking out on those gardens that Babylon was so familiar with, that everyone else is so familiar with. And he was bragging about what he had done and lifting himself up as if he himself were God. And this is what it was said to him. You'll be driven from mankind, and your dwelling place will be among the beasts of the field, and you will be given grass to eat like cattle, and will be drenched with the dew of heaven. And 7 periods of time will pass over you until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it to whomever he wishes. They say his hair grew like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird claws. That this actually happened to him. That he went out and he lived amongst the cows and he ate grass and he crawled around on all fours for a time. Then one day it dawned on him, I'm not God. If I was a God, could this be done to me? But there is a God. The true God. The living God. You understand that very often, in order for God to build any of us up, he must first break us down. I mean, this is not something that's new just for Nebuchadnezzar. I experience the same thing in a sense, in a spiritual sense. No, I don't like grass. And no, I don't eat with the cows. You understand that the greatest sin, that all sin of mankind could be summarized as rebellion against the true God? And any time you rebel against the true God, what you're saying in essence is, you're not God, I am. So what are we going to do with this? How do we put this into perspective? Well, if you're familiar with the Bible, you know that really the New Testament equivalent of Old Testament Israel / Judah is the church of Jesus Christ. And when I say that, I'm talking that in general terms. You know, every church, every person that would claim some association with Jesus Christ. We understand there are a lot of people who don't. One of the interesting things is there are a lot of other religions, like Judaism, for instance, and in Islam, that really have a very high regard for Jesus. They claim that Jesus was a great prophet. But what you want to say to him is, if he was a great prophet, why don't you listen to what he said? But they're deaf to it. See, God has an enemy in this world. He's been partly bound. He goes by different names: Satan, Lucifer, Apollyon. These Babylonians were children of Satan. But I want to challenge you with the idea of understanding this, and this is not me saying this, this is Scripture saying this, that a lot of the people in Israel, a lot of the people in Judah also were children of Satan, even though they claimed to be children of God. And it's true for absolutely every person that has ever breathed the air. Either you're a child of God or a child of Satan. There's no in between. There's no riding the fence in this one. You can't be half one way and half the other way. And one of my greatest fears is that's where a lot of people really are. They want to convince themselves that they know enough about Jesus that they're going to heaven when they die. And yet they live their life as if there was no knowledge or understanding of him at all. Do you understand that there will be a setting apart here? Are there true believers in Judah when this takes place? Are there true believers in Jerusalem? I hope we would come to the conclusion, at least Jeremiah and Habakkuk were. And we understand there were lots of other ones. But at the same time, there was so much wickedness and evilness embedded in all of it that Israel and Judah not only looked like the world, Israel and Judah looked worse than the world. Now let me ask you something. What do you think God concludes as he looks out upon the current culture in the United States of America? We talked about abortion last week. That we could bring up all kinds of things. I was at home. I actually exercise a couple of times a week, even if it doesn't show. But I turn on the TV when I'm doing that because I hate to do sit-ups. And if I can watch TV, you know, and I don't concentrate on so much on what I'm doing, it maybe doesn't hurt quite as much. But I turn on the TV, and you never guess what. And I had in my room, in my living room, right there in front of my face, without invitation, an absolutely naked woman who looked like she was 16 years old. And it wasn't on some adult channel. It was on one of the regular movie channels. Doesn't it blow your mind that stuff like this is happening? And it's everywhere you look. You need to understand that God's still in the patience part. He's tolerating all of this for some reason. Unbeknownst to us, there is a reason. But we know that Jesus is coming back one of these days, right? And when he comes, he's going to make it very clear who are the children of Satan and who are the children of God. There will be no mixing at that point. There will be no mistake. You understand that this whole thing with Judah and Jerusalem and Israel is just a microcosm of the overall picture of the whole Bible. It's just the same thing over and over and over again. Do you think the world's testing God's patience today? Do you think that God's just going to let it go on forever? No. But as far as this church goes, the sad thing is this. Is so many church people today live their life just like everybody else. They do the same things. They read the same things. They dress the same. They do this the same. Let me tell you guys, in this culture that we're in today, people who truly love the Lord and serve the Lord ought to stand out like sore thumbs. And let me tell you something, sometimes they do. I've talked about my college classes a few times, but let me tell you something. Usually I start out with 60 kids. This semester was a few less than that because enrollment's down for all kinds of reasons. But let me tell you, usually within the first couple of weeks, I can tell you which of those are church kids. Because let me tell you, they are different. And they do stand out like sore thumbs. I think a lot of people today are very much down on young people. But we have some very bright, shining lights out there that are doing their best to make a difference where they're at. We talk very often, or hear the military talk very often, about not leaving a man behind. They also tell each other all the time, I've got your back. These young people, my friend, they need to know that we have their back. We need to pray. God is merciful, but God is also just. He has to be both, or he wouldn't be God. And just remember that gospel every day, that every one of us in this room is, in a sense, a microcosm of this whole thing, too. That everyone in this room knows they did some things this week they shouldn't have done, and they haven't repented of them. Very often it's so easy for us to see the sin in other people's lives and not see the sin in our own life at all, to be blinded by it completely. Very willing to point fingers at other people, but we never point the finger at me. So what can we be encouraged about? We can be encouraged about this. So we know God's a mighty God. God's victorious. These kind of things may upset you and me, and they upset God, don't get me wrong, but we know this. We know that ultimately, in the end, God's going to make everything right. Everything right. People may threaten you and I, But no one's a threat to our God. And ultimately, because no one's a threat to him, they're not a threat to his children either. Some horrible things going on in our world today and recently in one of these mass shootings. And this hasn't been publicized very much, which just ticks me off something big time. That the victims who were chosen were Christians who refused to deny their Lord, and they were killed for it in the good old U.S. of A. It's here. We're going to celebrate or administer the Lord's Supper this morning.